Well, imagine with me that you have a son who is your pride and joy. You have very high hopes and dreams for him. You want him to be a far better man than you ever were. And so one day, you're taking him to class, and you have a very serious conversation with him. Son, you say, you're becoming a man now. And so it's time for you to start manning up and taking on the responsibilities of manhood. In class, you need to be a leader. You need to take on that mantle of leadership. You need to fight against temptation. You need to resist peer pressure. You need to go against the flow and lead your class rather than being led by other people. You need to show maturity and leadership with them. You need to demonstrate wisdom in your decisions, prudence in your words, and righteousness in your actions. Remember, son, you represent your mother and me in all that you say and do, so represent us well. And then you leave your two-year-old in the church nursery. Well, that's not the sort of conversation you'd have with a toddler, is it? No. What is it that you would say to your toddler as you drop him off at the nursery? Don't bite. Right? There are things that you would say. Don't bite. Be nice to others. Share your toys. Don't hit. Don't lick the toys. Right? Don't put these things in your mouth. Wash your hands. You say these kinds of things. Lots of rules that we give to our children. See, it's not until your child is older that you can begin discussing these kinds of conversations about wisdom and choices, living for a greater purpose than instant gratification. These concepts require some maturity to understand and to embrace. So when children are young, we give them lots of rules. We get them lots of different things that they have to do. They must obey in all these ways. Do the right thing. It's not until they're older that we give them these more abstract concepts like do the right thing. Be wise in your choices. Represent your parents well. Represent God well. You see, rules are really for the immature. Rules are not for those who have maturity. The principles that we want our children to live by are based on the rules. So there are rules. We all have rules that we must live by. But the rules really point us to a greater principle or greater principles. I mean, for example, we teach our young children they shouldn't bite. That's a good rule to live by, whether you're DeMarquier or Miss Shirley. You shouldn't go around biting no matter what your age is. But what does that rule really point our children to? Well, we teach our children to not bite because we want them to understand what respect for others looks like. We want them to understand that there are limits to their personal freedom. You don't have the right to place someone else's hand into your mouth and bite down. Just like there are other rights that you don't have in other areas of life. We want them to recognize that their behavior affects others. Problem is, you can't say that to a two-year-old. So what do you say to a two-year-old? Don't bite. It's the rule that is pointing to a greater principle. But because of the child's age, we have to speak in language they understand. Well, it shouldn't come as any surprise to us that God works with us in the same way. Look at this from Paul's letter to the Galatians. He wrote this. He said, "Now before faith came, we were held captive under the law." He's talking about the law of Moses. "Imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed. So then, the law was our guardian until Christ came, in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian." Paul says that prior to Jesus coming, we are held captive under the law. That is, God's people were governed by a series of rules. There were the Big Ten, the Ten Commandments. Along with those Ten Commandments were 603 other rules that they had to live by. Things like, don't eat lobster. Don't trim the corners of your beard. Don't work on Saturday. Don't mix cotton and wool in your clothing. Don't get tattoos. Just don't. Or do. Under the old way of things, it was all about the rules. Everything had a rule to govern it. But do you see what Paul says here in this text? He says we were held captive by the law until the coming faith would be revealed. Now, what's he talking about? He says the law was our guardian until Christ came. Now, the word here, guardian, really has the idea of a tutor. Now, in the ancient world, a family would hire a tutor to make sure their kids were educated. The tutor would often do, like, tutoring, would actually do some of the teaching, but also part of their responsibilities were making sure that the kids got to the other tutors, got to the other classes that they were supposed to do. They didn't go off skipping and swimming in the river, that they actually went to where they were supposed to go. And when they came home, they actually came home to do their homework. A tutor controlled the child. A tutor placed all these rules and restrictions around the child to make sure the child did the right thing. Paul says that was true of us under the law of Moses until Jesus came. But now that Jesus has come, we don't need a tutor to keep us in line anymore because we've grown up in Christ. So what happens is we move from rules to principles. Now, we still have rules. Okay, we have rules we must live by, but those rules are best understood through the principles that they point to. That's what Paul is getting at in Colossians chapter 3. So if you would, turn there with me as we continue our study of Paul's letter to the Colossians. If you have one of these black Bibles, it's page 984. We're going to look at verses 12 through 17. Originally, I was planning to do all those verses, but as I was writing, I realized I had to break this up into two, and so we'll look at the second half of this text later next week. But let's read the whole text together this morning. Paul writes, "Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other, as the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you are called in one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him." Now, after listing five vices back in verse 5 of chapter 3, Paul lists five virtues for God's people. I have to say that I would love to spend a week on each one of these virtues. I would love to spend a week talking about how we put on compassionate hearts, another week talking about how we put on kindness or how we put on humility, how we put on meekness, how we put on patience, how we can engage in those activities on a practical level. But I think if I did that, we would quickly lose sight of what Paul's real point here is. You see, these five virtues aren't meant to be a list of commandments for us to obey. They're not meant to be rules. They are principles for how God wants us to live. And there's a huge difference between the two. He writes in verse 12. We'll talk about that in a moment. He writes in verse 12. He says, "Put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved." Now, in the Old Covenant, prior to Jesus coming, God's chosen ones were primarily from one nation. They were the physical descendants of Abraham through his son Isaac and through his son Jacob. They were physical descendants of Abraham. They were the people of God, primarily. They had the law of Moses to govern their lives. Paul is writing this letter to the Colossians. They were Gentiles, which meant they weren't descended from Abraham through his son Isaac and through Isaac's son Jacob. They were outside the camp, so to speak. And yet, Paul says, you, despite your upbringing, despite your family tree, you are God's chosen ones, holy and beloved. He says they must put on these virtues. Now, go back up to verse 10 for a moment. This is Pastor Dan covered this text last week. But in verse 10, he says, talking about these Colossians, they have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. Here, there is not Greek and Jew, circumcised and uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave, free, but Christ is all and is in all. Paul says here, in God's people, in God's community, there's this new humanity that is being created in the image of Christ. He says here, in this new people of God, there are no distinctions. There are very real distinctions that exist outside the church, but he says within the church, those distinctions don't matter. See, outside the church, you were either physically descended from Abraham through Isaac and Jacob, or you weren't. You were either a Jewish person, or you were something else. Greek, Gentile, whatever you want to call it. That was a real distinction. Becoming a Christian didn't change your family tree. He says, in the church, that thing that distinction doesn't matter. He says they were either circumcised or they weren't part of the tradition of faithfulness to God. Here he's referring to religious upbringing. Inside the church, how you grew up isn't what matters. He says outside the church, there are people who are identified as barbarians. Now, in that day, a barbarian was simply anyone who was not part of the broader Roman culture. If you had a different culture from that of the Roman Empire, you were a barbarian. It was bad enough to be a barbarian, but then there was this other group of people called Scythians. The Scythians were so barbaric that they made the barbarians look like they gathered every afternoon for tea. Right? That they were just really, really civilized. That's how far out of the main culture they were. Paul says, look, it doesn't matter what your culture is. Inside the church, those real distinctions that exist outside the church don't matter. That's not how we distinguish one another. He goes on, he says that there are some who are slave or free, that in the church, that doesn't matter. Now, that was largely in that day a socioeconomic distinction. It was a class distinction. There were those who had very little power because they had very little money. They had very little control over their lives. They were the slaves. And then there were the people with all the money. They were the people who were the free people. They got to make the decisions that affected everybody else. Paul says those real distinctions that don't change outside the church don't matter inside the church. We are a community of God. He says here, in this new people of God created by Jesus, those distinctions don't matter. Now remember who Paul's writing to or what he's writing about. He's writing about the community of God's people, how we exist together in community. The five vices that he listed in verse 5 are things that destroy community. Sexual immorality, impurity, uncontrolled passion, evil desire, and covetousness. The distinctions that are real distinctions don't exist in the church. Now, we're still black or white or Hispanic or Asian, right? We still have these distinctions. We're still urban or suburban. We're still educated or uneducated or something between. We're still, you know, poverty class or upper middle class or something in the middle. We still either show up for weddings on time or we show up for weddings on urban standard time. You see, faith in Jesus doesn't take a young black man and make him something else. It makes him a young black man who follows Jesus. Faith in Jesus doesn't make an older white woman something other than an older white woman who follows Jesus. Those distinctions remain distinctions, but in the church, they don't separate us. That's his point here. We're different people. We come from different places. We think differently. We approach life in some different ways because of our upbringing. Paul said that doesn't matter. What matters is Jesus. See, in the church, in God's new community of people, don't matter. We follow Jesus. That's why Paul gives us these five virtues. He says, put on then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. Now the phrase compassionate hearts is literally compassionate bowels. Bowels of compassion. In the ancient world, the bowels were the seat of emotion and of love. Of course, today it wouldn't say somebody that you wouldn't work to say to someone, I love you from my guts. Just doesn't really fit. So we translate hearts because that's something we understand. It's really the same idea. So we have compassionate hearts. It means that we love one another, that we care for one another. Paul says, don't let the real distinctions that exist be a barrier to showing love to one another in the gathered assembly, in the community of faith. It goes on, kindness. Kindness is simply showing God's goodness to other people. It is how we act toward other people. Paul said, look, be nice to each other. Simple rule, right? Simple principle. Humility was a distinctly Christian virtue in Paul's day. It was not something that people aspired to in the Roman culture. Humility was looked down upon. Humility meant to be servile. It meant to be less than. Nobody wanted to be humble. Humble meant you were less. In his letter to the Philippians, Paul said, look at Jesus. Jesus is God, and yet Jesus humbled himself by becoming a servant. See, it doesn't matter what your station is in this world, what kind of work you do, how much money you make at it, how much authority you have in the society. It doesn't matter how great your natural talents and abilities are. Whatever they are, it's less than what Jesus has. And yet Jesus was able to be humble. So Paul says, be humble. The next one is similar to that. Meekness. Meekness is simply the state of not being overly impressed with yourself. We all know the guy who thinks he's the greatest thing to happen to a basketball court, or the woman who thinks nobody can wear her dress the way she wears her dress, or there's always that other guy who knows more than everybody else, who's never wrong, and the only thing he wants anyone else to know is the fact that he's never wrong. They can get that one, they've nailed it. The fact is, we have to get over ourselves. We're way too impressed with us. We need to focus on the one who really is all that. And finally, Paul says we must be patient. Now, kindness is how we act toward others. We are good to others. Patience is how we react to others. It's how we respond to who they are and what they do. The fact is, God is patient toward us, and we give him a lot of junk. And yet he reacts to us in a very different way than we often react. You know, frankly, I promise you, there's no one here who has to be patient with more stuff than God has to be patient with. Right? I mean, God is patient with each one of us. There's no one here bearing that burden. We give God lots of opportunities to show patience. And so we need to respond to others in the same way. So Paul gives these five principles, these five virtues that ought to describe our community together, our life together as followers of Jesus. But how? How do we actually demonstrate these things? Remember, these aren't rules. Be patient. This is what it should look like. How do we go about doing that? Right? I mean, I know you're sitting there. It's like, hurry up, man. Talk to us about patience. Right? How do we do it? Well, Paul doesn't leave us hanging. That's the good news. He gives us a couple ways that we're to live out these five virtues in community. And let me say, these are not things that can be checked off a list. Right? I did this and I did that. That's not that sort of list. Look at verse 13 again. He's talking about in this community of faith, we are bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive. These are two ways in which these five virtues work themselves out in our community. First, he says it's by bearing with one another. And I wish I could make that sound nicer than it is. But that's where it means what it says. You have to bear with one another, which means you have to put up with one another. Let me give you an example of this, an actual illustration. There's a man I know at another church in the area, well-respected in the community. He's actually respected nationally. If I told you his name, some of you would recognize his name. He has, like, big people who, you know, nationally who will call him for advice. And he's a great man, a godly man. He's an elder at his church. There's another man at his church who is not that. This other man is obnoxious, he's a bore, he's overly opinionated, he's rude, he's harsh, he has a rough exterior, he's hard to be around. I can't imagine that this other man has any friends whatsoever. He's just not the guy that you say, hey, let's go watch the game together. Like, oh, he's coming. Right? And yet this first man invites this other guy out to lunch on a regular basis, usually once a month or so. They'll talk together, and usually it's the one listening to the other for a couple of hours, talking about some inane, boring stuff that nobody really cares about. And yet the first guy is bearing with him. He just listens. Well, one day, he invited his adult son to come along. So he and his son ride to this guy's apartment. They pick him up. They go to the restaurant. He listens to him drone on and on for a couple hours. They drive back to the guy's apartment, his son sitting in the backseat. They drive back, and the guy continues talking about everything that's wrong with the world and how unhappy he is about everything. They drop him off, and the son stays in the backseat. Dad drives away, and it's really quiet. After a few minutes, the son just said, Dad, do you like him? Dad waited a moment before responding. Not yet. That's what Paul's talking about. When he says we have to bear with one another, that means we have to put up with one another, personality quirks and all. We don't have to like each other, but we do have to bear with one another. The fact is, there are going to be people in the church who rub you the wrong way. They have, you know, annoying habits. There are going to be people who go to the Citigroup Olympics who are going to be overly competitive and loud and obnoxious. But Paul says you have to bear with me. I mean, with him, whoever that would be. If such a thing were to happen. Fact is, we have to bear with people like that. In the community of faith, we bear with one another as we exhibit compassionate hearts, humility, meekness, kindness, patience. Well, that's for people who are annoying. Just annoying, like irritating. What about people who actually wrong you? People who actually do things to offend you? Paul says, if anyone has a complaint against another, then we should be forgiving each other. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you must also forgive one another. Now, I know this is going to be a shock to some of you, but the church is made up of people who are sinners who sin. I know it's... None of us here is perfect. And because not one of us is perfect, that means from time to time we're going to sin. And sometimes when we sin against each other. What is our response supposed to be? Paul says, forgive. And it's not just the forgiveness that says, look, I'm not going to be angry at you anymore, but I'm also not going to talk to you. I'll forgive you by not punching you in the face, but I'm also not going to sit next to you at the church picnic. I'm not going to talk to you on Sunday mornings. I'm not going to sit by you at Citigroup. That's not the forgiveness that he's talking about. How are we supposed to forgive? He says you forgive as the Lord has forgiven you. How is it that Jesus forgives us? Jesus forgives us by doing away with our offense. It's not that he just says, I'm not going to get you for it. It's that he wipes it off the books entirely. See, each one of us has offended God through our rebellion, through our refusal to value the things God values, through our refusal to despise the thing God despises. We overlook God, we minimize him. Every time we disobey God in some way, whatever the sin is, we're rejecting him as God and declaring that we ourselves are God. It's like Adam in the garden. It's like, I know you said not to eat this fruit, but I'm going to make my own rules. I'm going to be God for a while. So God, you come off your throne and let me get up there. Every time we sin, that's what we're saying to God. When we turn from our sin, though, and we come to Jesus in faith, Jesus forgives us and he makes us his own. Let me illustrate it this way. Let's say you kill someone. You are now a murderer. And you go to trial. The jury hears your side of it and they think, okay, you know what? We're going to forgive this guy. And so the jury comes back, unanimous decision, not guilty. They know you did it, but they're not going to hold it against you. And so you walk away a free man. That's not how God forgives us. Yes, God eliminates the penalty by giving the penalty to Jesus, but if that's all he were doing, that's not what the Bible describes as forgiveness. Now imagine that same jury says, you know what? Not only are we going to say not guilty, but we're going to give you $1 million a year for the rest of your life. If that happened to you, now you're starting to get a little glimpse of what it means for God to forgive us. He removes the penalty, but then he also blesses us with the greatest blessing he can give us. He doesn't just say, I'm not mad at you anymore, but stay away. He says, I'm not mad at you anymore, come to me. You get me forever. That's what biblical forgiveness is. When Paul says, forgive one another as the Lord has forgiven you, that means you overlook the offense and you restore the relationship. You don't just sit on opposite sides of the church. We have to forgive one another that way. When we forgive in this way, we're showing compassionate hearts. We're showing kindness. We're showing meekness. We're showing humility. We're showing patience. When we bear with one another and when we forgive one another, we're showing love. Look at verse 14. And above all these, put on love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. This is how we love one another in community. When Jesus was asked, which of these commandments is the greatest? He said, the greatest commandment of all the commandments, all 603, the greatest is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And without missing a beat, he says, and the second is just like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. These two commandments are really just a summary of all the rules that God's people had to live by in the old covenant. Love God and love people. Do you see any parallels to last week's message? In many ways, last week's message was difficult for me to hear. Pastor Dan preached. It was difficult for me to hear because I realized halfway through that he was preaching to me, about me. It was uncomfortable because I realized how far short I fall on a regular basis. But of all those vices that Dan listed, those are sins done in the body, in the community. They're sins against God by sinning against one another. There's really no such thing as a private sin. We like to think they're private because we do it when no one else knows about it. But the fact is, there are no sins that are truly private, that only affect the person sinning. I mean, my impure thoughts aren't just between me and my elbow. When I get angry, I'm not mad because of what my toe did. I'm not coveting something that I already own. And I'm certainly not gossiping about myself. See, to sin against one another in this way isn't loving one another. Do you see the principle here? If I love you, I won't gossip about you. If I love you, I won't steal your stuff. If I love you, I won't think impure thoughts about you. If I love you, I won't hold every offense against you. Do you see what Paul's talking about here? He's describing how it is that we actually become righteous. We're declared righteous because of our faith in Jesus, but how do we actually become righteous in our day-to-day lives? It's not about the rules. Paul says, put on compassionate hearts, put on kindness, put on humility, put on meekness, put on patience. We do this by bearing with one another and by forgiving one another in community. We do it by loving one another. See, sometimes we want to go back to the rules. Life was much simpler when the only thing you had to worry about was don't bite. If that's all you had to worry about, got that one nailed. Haven't bitten anyone in a very long time. 10 years or so. Fact is, we can keep rules. We can check them off and we can feel pretty good when we start comparing ourselves to a list of rules. You know, it's much easier to avoid doing certain things than it is to try to become a certain kind of person. See, we want a list of rules because rules are attainable. Then we can say, I didn't do that, but I did do this other thing. Look at me. I've got it made because I can check these things off. Never mind that I'm not yet the man that God created me to be. I fall short in a lot of ways. See, our human nature wants us to push the envelope as far as we can. It wants us to push the rules as far as we can. And that's the good thing about rules. It tells us how far is too far. The problem, though, is the rules can't actually get at the problem. The problem is a heart that's corrupt. The problem is a heart that wants to break the rules, but sometimes is too afraid to break the rules, and sometimes not. The rules can't actually control our hearts. Our hearts need to be changed. And as God changes our hearts, He changes our behavior. See, we need to value the things God values. And what does God value? He values compassionate hearts. He values humility. He values kindness. He values meekness. He values patience. So we need to value these things. We need to value the things of God. As we do that, God changes our hearts. And as God changes our hearts, God changes our behavior. See, our focus needs to be on Jesus and not on the rules. When we start comparing ourselves to a checklist, we can look pretty good. But when we start comparing ourselves to Jesus, yeah, it becomes very obvious very quickly that we're not all that we thought we were. When we look to Jesus, we see that we continue to fall far short of what God created us to be. And so we cling to Jesus. We trust in Jesus to continue to be our righteousness, to continue to be the one who makes us right with God, even as God's principles continue to change us. So we obey the rules God gives us. There are rules. They're here. They're real. But we always look to Jesus as the real standard. So we look to Jesus because Jesus shows us how far we have to go. And Jesus reminds us that He's already taken us there. All we do is trust Jesus. The more we trust Jesus, the more we become like Him. The more we become like Him, the more we obey God.